how I began. And, as I said last time, the most significant thing that we could do to honor the deceased is to learn Torah, and I want to dedicate tonight's year to the memory of my father, Zichron Levracha, at Yahrzeit tonight. And once again, afterwards, I'll like to say the Kaddish to Rabbanan, and then we'll daven Ma'ariv. The subject of tonight's class is something which I think it's the kind of thing that everybody recognizes is a problem. It could be one of the most difficult areas to control, and that is the area of speech. It's difficult because we live in a certain culture, and basically we have the idea of freedom of speech. That is to say, it's a free country, and more or less the person has a feeling that that's under his control. He can say whatever he wants to say. Of course, everybody recognizes that there has to be some limitations. Even in America, which is very big, freedom of speech, you can't interfere with freedom of speech. But still in all, any society recognizes that there has to be certain limitations. For example, the famous case, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater, something like that. But basically, everybody recognizes that there's limitations when it has to do with harming somebody else. So that's the boundary line. As we said, causing a hysteria or even slander, to slander someone, to defame, libel, false testimony. It's an impossibility to have an absolute concept of freedom of speech. That every society will recognize that you have to have limitations. But I think that most people recognize limitations only when there's a practical damage. If there's practical damage, so then you have to restrain your speech. But I think people, on the other hand, feel that where you're not causing any practical harm, in our cases like that, of course you should be very, very careful, because very often you feel that you're not causing practical harm, but I think everybody has learned through experience that you regret a lot of the things you said. When you said them, you didn't think that it would go anywhere, so that there'd be any consequences. It's a good idea in general to be careful what you say and to who you say, but let's face it, there are many cases where you're talking about people and you feel pretty confident that they'll never find out about it, or they won't even be harmed by it. You criticize people, you can make fun out of people, and these people are not present, and let's assume that they'll never find out about it. Now, that's something which we're going to focus on tonight. Now, the average individual would say that there's nothing wrong with it. This is something that everybody engages in. It's built into the nature of people. The Hebrew expression is lashon hara, evil speech. It's a broad category. And we're going to focus on this particular area because it's difficult, I believe, for many people to imagine living their life without indulging in some type of gossip. Everybody's involved in gossip and talking about other people. And of course, it's not difficult for me to make people feel guilty about this, because along with it, everybody feels a certain unease about it. People feel guilty, it's not nice, it's not the right thing to do. On the other hand, therefore people are always involved in making resolutions to curb it, not to engage in it, not to make fun out of other people, not to derive enjoyment out of other people's weaknesses, and so forth. But we live in a culture that's steeped in lashon hara. I'm going to be using the Hebrew term, it's again evil speech, gossip. And you pick up your newspaper, any newspaper, even respectable newspapers, they just do it in a more sophisticated way. Correct? I mean, you have newspapers that are at least honest. That's basically what they're all about. National Enquirer, things of that type. They don't make any pretense towards being legitimate newspapers. But you can read it in the New York Times as well. It's just done in a more sophisticated way, or biographies. And there's always a tremendous justification, especially if it's a public figure. Because then there's the justification that there's a need to know. Yeah, really, there's a real need to know about all the person's shortcomings and mistakes and embarrassments. Really, I really need to know. And therefore you read it very avidly because you're a student of history. So, so you're doing a good thing. And meanwhile, it's a great enjoyment because the bigger they are, I mean, the more enjoyment there is to see their weaknesses and their foibles. And every newspaper has a gossip column, I'm pretty sure. I don't read every newspaper, but I'm pretty familiar with that. And every TV program, it's a standard thing. And people make build big careers. You know, Walter Winchell was one of the early ones, but today there's plenty of them. And I don't think when a person reads this that they even consider that there may be something morally wrong with it. The only criterion that they use, if it's true or if it's not true. So if something is not true, then you can sue for libel. But if it is true, then it seems perfectly legitimate to print it, to make it public, even though it is causing tremendous harm. This is a case where it is causing tremendous harm to the individual about whom you're writing. Certainly they don't appreciate it. I mean, well, to a certain extent today, everybody likes publicity. But, so that's what they say, even bad publicity. There's no such thing as bad publicity. But no, there's no question that there are many of the things that are being printed, even if they're true, the mere fact that they're being held up to the public is extremely painful. But that's the kind of thing we don't think about. We engage in it, and we imagine, when it, I didn't hurt anybody, no one's being hurt by this, you're talking about somebody, and therefore, the attitude is there's nothing wrong. And Judaism takes a completely different approach. And in Judaism, this area is extremely significant, and I'll point out tonight from the sources that it could be the most serious area, one of the most serious areas, in terms of violating. That is to say, if a person does not understand it and does not gain control over this area, if he engages, and he could be a very good person in many other respects, if he indulges this desire, it could lead to very serious consequences in terms of his standing in the eyes of God, which is the thing that concerns us the most. So what I'd like to do tonight is to try and use a different approach. Instead of instilling guilt in people, making them feel guilty and small-minded and petty, and walking away with a resolution not to engage in Lashon Hara ever again, I won't do that, because ever again is usually about 15 minutes or so. That's about the that's long. By the time you get home, somebody calls on the phone and there's a juicy tidbit, and it's okay. Well, like, ever again is over. That's it. So I'm going to try a different approach. And I think that people don't undertake any significant change unless they're really convinced, unless they really see that something is bad for them, that something is harming them. You can see it in many areas. Doctors, of course, will know that you can tell a person not to eat fatty foods, cholesterol, and he just denies it, or people smoke and they just deny it. But when you show a person an x-ray, or if he sees that his arteries are clogged, then he sees it for himself, and then he has an impact. And then maybe he'll change. So what I'm going to try and point out tonight is the underlying philosophical reason. Why is Judaism so opposed to something which, on certain levels, does not seem to be that terrible, doesn't seem to be that significant? And that's what I'd like to address tonight, is the subject of Lashon Hara. And I'd like to start off by reading a little bit from the Rambam. That's Maimonides' Code of Jewish Law. And he says that a person is called Meragel Bachavero, one who is a talebearer. See, there's two different types of evil speech that we're going to be discussing. We're going to focus more on the second one, which is commonly known as Lashon Hara. But the first one is one who's a talebearer, violates a negative commandment. So it's a negative commandment of the Torah to be a talebearer. But what exactly is a talebearer? As it says in the Torah, you shall not walk as a talebearer among your nation. And he says, even though there's no punishment for this by the court, it's an interesting idea that there are many sins that are very serious that don't carry any punishment of the court. We don't have the Jewish court today that could punish, but in the time when we did. He says, don't be mistaken. Even though there's no punishment, nevertheless, it is considered to be a very serious evil, and it causes destruction. It causes great destruction in society. Therefore, the very next verse, juxtaposition, the Torah uses the methodology of juxtaposing one verse next to the other to make a point. The verse that comes immediately after when it says you shall not be a talebearer is you shall not stand idly by the blood of your brother. That is to say, another interesting concept in Judaism, that is to say, if another individual is in danger, if you pass by, someone's in an accident or someone is drowning, someone needs assistance, are you obligated? Do you have an obligation to stop and give assistance? Now, as far as I know, to the best of my knowledge, in the American legal system, you're not obligated. You can't be brought up on charges. If you do stop and help, you're called a good Samaritan. That's a good Samaritan. That's a good person, a high-level person. He didn't leave the person drowned. He stopped and tried to help him. But according to Jewish law, it's an obligation. It's a commandment. A person that would walk away, in a sense, would partake of being involved in murder. Because since you had the opportunity to save the person, your failure to do so is considered to be a cause of his destruction. So, of course, that all assumes that you have the ability to help him. If the person is drowning and you can't swim, you don't have to jump into the water and risk your own life. Or it all depends. If someone needs medical assistance, if you're a doctor, if you know how to give medical assistance, if you don't know what to do, so then that's something else, and it's not your fault unless you can make a phone call and call for help. This is interesting. There's a famous case in our society, a very famous case. Anybody remember? No, but there's an actual Kitty Genovese, I believe. Kitty Genovese. Was that in the 60s? Very, very... This was in Queens. That became a very, very famous case in that this woman was being killed and screaming, and it was clear afterwards that many, many people heard the screams and nobody wanted to get involved, and she died. So that's looked upon as being not nice, not good, and so forth. According to Jewish law, it's a biblical prohibition. Thou shalt not stand idly by the blood of your brother. But that is associated with talebearing. The Torah placed it over there to let you know that the sin of talebearing is akin to the sin of spilling of blood, of murder, because it causes a destruction. Then he cites certain cases from Tanakh where this actually happened. I can't go into that right now. And then he says, what exactly is talebearing? That's someone who carries, so to speak. It's like a merchant. The term in Hebrew implies a certain type of a merchant. He carries merchandise from one, he obtains merchandise from one, and he goes from this person to the other person, and he says, this is what so-and-so told me. I don't know if you're familiar with these kinds of people. They go visit someone, and they listen for information, and then they get the information, and they go running exactly to the next person to tell them this information, of course causing tremendous attention and strife. Well, that's what he means. That's a person, it's some type of a sick personality, it seems to me. Because what taught me to relate to that? What kind of enjoyment would the person find in that? But that's someone who's actively involved in orchestrating the destruction of others through posing as a friend, visiting one person, posing as a friend, and gaining that person's confidence, then taking the information and using it and telling the other person, who you know very well, is going to get upset and cause a clash. A conflict between these two people. That is the form of Lashon Hara which violates the biblical prohibition when it's on that level. And he goes to the other person, he says, look, this is what I just heard the other person saying about you, to cause hatred and enmity between people. Now the Rambam makes the point that even if it's true, it has nothing. Bear in mind that this prohibition does not depend upon whether it's factually true or not. Even if what you're saying is 100% true, this person is involved in the destruction of the world. It's a very base, it's a very corrupt type of a personality. That's one thing. Now, then he goes on to say that there is a sin that is even greater than this. I want to focus on the second one. I don't know to what extent people are engaged in the first kind. I think that the second kind is more prevalent. If I'm wrong, then, you know, each person has to address himself to the one that he's involved in. I have a reason for why I'm saying that. I think most people, the reason I'm saying that is because I sense that, you see, in Lashon Hara, in evil talk, as we'll see, there's a tremendous temptation because it gives us an outlet to certain very powerful emotions which we really can't express in a direct way. You can't come out openly and take a machine gun and start shooting down people or destroying your enemies overtly. There's consequences, but then there's a subtle way in which you can bring them down. A way in which you can still masquerade it from yourself. There's a subtle way. So through Lashon Hara, through spreading tales, through telling other people who are potential enemies what this person said about them, you can orchestrate the destruction of others, thereby gratifying your desires in a way, and still be able to pose as someone who's a good person. I didn't do anything. What did I do? I just said something. That's why it poses such a danger. But he says that there's a worse type of a situation, and that is one who speaks about the shame, about the weaknesses of his friend, of a fellow Jew. So this is the kind, I think, that's much more prevalent. This is not a talebearer going from one place to another. It's just people getting together and talking about someone who's not present, obviously, and criticizing them or making fun out of them or discussing their weaknesses, their shame. Again, even though what you're saying is true. Of course, he says, but if what you're saying is false, that's a worse violation. That's called moti shem ra'al chavero. That's lying and slandering a person and giving the person a false reputation. He's saying, forget about that. I'm not talking about that. Even if everything you're saying is true, the person did those actions, the person has those weaknesses, the person is stupid, said something stupid, but to sit around and talk about it and derive enjoyment from it, he says, that is lashon hara, and that is worse than the first case. That's very, very interesting. He says, but a baal lashon hara. Baal is like a master. Someone, he means to say someone who indulges, that the speaking of lashon hara is not just an occasional thing, but it's part of his lifestyle. And I think that's something we should pay attention to as well. That from time to time, as I said, this is a very powerful emotion, and it comes up. Somebody says something, you respond. It's difficult to imagine that a person is never ever going to be involved in lashon hara. But then there's a different type of a situation, a personality with whom it's a permanent part of their lifestyle. They're always engaged in this kind of talk. You know that. And they may even have a chain of friends, telephone. You have a certain friend you call every day or every other day, and you know the nature of the conversation, passing back information up and back and just engaging in this kind of talk. Or certain social situations, when you get together, it's just automatic. That's what the Rambam is talking about. Someone who engages in this thing, not accidentally once in a while, but someone for whom it's a part of their lifestyle. He says, that's a person who just sits around and talks about others. This one did this, or this one, their parents were, talks about their parents, makes fun of their parents, or this is what I heard about such a person. All of these things are negative. That is to sit around and to derive benefit from pointing out the negatives of other people. Now he goes on to say something which is very, very fascinating. And this is what I want to analyze. The statement that he makes, which I think, if we understand it, will take us to the heart of what this is all about. The rabbi said, there are three sins for which a person is punished in this world, and he loses his share in the world to come. Now, whenever you hear the words, that's in Hebrew, Ein lo chelek l'olam haba, does not have a share in the world to come, you know we're talking about something very serious in Judaism. Of course, according to Judaism, if a person lives properly, he perfects his soul, so therefore he has the best possible life in this world, but also we maintain that the soul does not share the fate of the body, that it's separate, it's a incorporeal, it's a non-physical element. If it's perfected, so then you have eternal life. And I'm not going to go into all of the parameters and all the aspects of that. But suffice it to say that that's the ultimate state of existence, that's the ultimate reward. So whenever we speak about a sin for which a person loses their share in the world to come, you're talking about the most serious sin. So he says, the rabbis have said that there are three sins that you're punished in this world and you lose your share in the world to come. That destroys the soul completely. And they are idolatry, Gilui Arayos is in to be involved in the serious sexual prohibitions, such as adultery, such as incest, serious sexual violations, and murder, the spilling of blood. Which means to say that all of these three are considered to be amongst the most serious possible sins, and what the rabbi says, v'loshen hara k'neged kulam. And loshen hara, evil speech, corresponds to all of them. That's an amazing kind of a thing. And that's what we're going to try and analyze. That when a person, it does not seem on the surface to reach the level of what we've just said, these three major sins. All right, maybe it's wrong, maybe you shouldn't derive pleasure, maybe you shouldn't talk about others. But now, what he's doing is he's saying that, in a sense, it's worse. Because it's not equal to one, it's equal to all three of them. So the question is, in what sense is Lashon Hara equal to all of these three major sins? Idolatry, forbidden sexual relationships, and murder. That's what he says. Moreover, he says, any person who speaks Lashon Hara, it's as though he denies God. It's considered to be a denial of God. That's a further development of the idea that it's idolatry. Moreover, they said that Lashon Hara destroys three parties. It destroys three. Who does it destroy? It destroys the one who speaks it. It destroys the one who receives it, who listens to it. So that's from which we learn that if someone wants to tell you Lashon Hara, you're not supposed to listen. You're supposed to excuse yourself, walk away. And you don't have to be worried about being impolite in those situations. So you don't want to hear it. And it destroys the one that they're talking about, assuming that the word gets out. Obviously, as I said, there are cases where it won't destroy him, but we're just talking in the abstract. Now, let me pose the question to you. He then goes on to say, who is the most destroyed by it? And before I tell you, I'd like to, who would you say is the, apparently he holds that the amount of destruction is not equal, but it's different. Of these three parties, who is the most destroyed by it? The speaker, the listener, or the third, the one that you're speaking about?
The speaker.
You'd say the speaker?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. But you're not the Rambam. Close. Close. Interestingly enough, I would have said okay, so you have something in common with them. Okay, 50-50. Very good. But now we'll get around to it, we'll see the explanation, if it was just a guess.
What about that fourth choice?
Actually, the Rambam does say, as Ben,
the listener.
The listener is the most destroyed. Of course, that's a question. On the basis of simple logic, I would have agreed with Abe. It seems that the one who speaks it, he initiates the sin, and it seems that he is the most culpable. The listener shouldn't listen, but you could say that person just reacted to a situation. So I'm going to try and explain what the Rambam means by that. But our first objective is to try and understand this place is Lashon Hara in an entirely different context. Up until this point in time, you didn't really know that there's something deep here, that there's something serious, and that it's a form of murder, it's a form of idolatry, it's a form of involvement in sexually prohibited acts. That sounds like a stretch, but that's what the rabbi said, and that's what we have to understand. And my assumption is that if you knew how that was the case, you wouldn't want to do it. That's the operating assumption. Now, in order to understand the basis, the foundation for the Torah's approach to the whole issue of speech, and why this becomes very significant, and why it's a crucial element in perfection, there's a very interesting statement in the Torah by the creation of Adam, and this is in Bereshit, by the creation of man. As you know, the Torah describes man as being composed of two elements. Of course, there's what we refer to as the Tzelem Elokim, the divine soul, the image of God, that man was created in the image of God, which means that he's not just an animal. That he's a unique animal. He possesses a special component, which gives him the capacity to have understanding and to recognize his creator. But also he's a physical being. He's an instinctual being. So in describing the creation of man, the Torah uses this type of terminology, that God blew into his nostrils the soul of life, and the man was a nefesh chaya, a living being, which is referring to man as an instinctual being. So this description over here is referring to the fact that man is an instinctual being like the other animals. Now Onkelos, who was the first to translate the Torah, he translates it L'ruach Memalola. Now that's an Aramaic term, a talking being, a talking spirit. So he refers to the uniqueness of man on the instinctual plane as being a being who has the ability to speak. So of course the question is, what does he mean by that? We assume, we always associate the power of speech to be connected to his ability to form ideas and to communicate. That's part of the divine element. Here he's saying no, that man is unique among all of the animals in that he is a talking animal. So what's the what is the meaning of that? From a psychological point of view, the explanation is that while man is an instinctual creature, just like the rest of the animals, but still, even on the instinctual level, he's different. He's different than the rest of the animals. And that is to say that he has instinctual drive. You take any animal. If an animal, you put an animal in a situation where it could satisfy its basic instinctual drive, its hunger, its desire for food, its sexual drive, all of the instinctual drive, then the animal will be in a state of contentment. That's all it needs. The same, however, is not true of man. If you take an individual, you put him in a situation, you give him the ability to satisfy all of his instinctual drives, then he'll be miserable. It's an impossibility. The reason is because he has so much energy, the psychic energy that a person has, and I don't have to get into graphic descriptions to illustrate what I'm talking about, cannot be satisfied through the activity of the instincts themselves. But man has another outlet for the gratification of his instincts. It's not really a successful one. When you think about it and you analyze it, it provides a certain amount, a partial satisfaction, but it also leads to frustration as well. And that is to say that what does a person do when they have a very powerful instinctual drive and it's frustrated? They can't gratify it. They can't express it. So what do? They talk about it. So man has the ability to express his instinctual urges through speech. That's what Onkelos was pointing out. And no other animal has that. Any other animal, if it has a drive, it can't talk about it and release the energy through speech. It has to have physical gratification. Of course, man desires physical gratification, but you see that his instincts become released through a tremendous amount of speech. He could talk about it and talk about it and talk about it. And that's what people do. That's the speech of most people is usually about things that stem from their instinctual desires. Because this is a very interesting thing. This could be a positive thing. In what area, in what the science, does this factor become something which is positive? Psychology. Anybody that's familiar with psychology, psychoanalysis, that's because this is the case. If people have deeply rooted psychological problems because of certain instinctual desires that are repressed, so then talking them through, a person, that's an example where it can be used for constructive purposes. But people don't understand, how is it possible that you had a tremendous anger, a buried resentment, and by merely associating and free associating and talking it through, you were able to work through the emotion without any action, purely through speech? Well, that's because of this phenomenon. So on the basis of that, this is the reason The reason why Judaism has to regulate the area of speech is because for man, the area of speech becomes a very powerful arena for the release and the gratification of very strong emotions and instincts. For example, what does a person do when he's extremely angry at someone? And he can't do anything physically. He's restrained from harming the person physically. Then he engages in verbal abuse. What does a person engage in verbal abuse? That's not the desire. The desire is to really hurt the person physically. But since he can't do that, either because he's afraid the other person will hit back, or because he'll be arrested, or because he'll face other consequences, so then that's the entire phenomenon of verbal destruction. But bear in mind, when you're attacking a person verbally, that's a substitute gratification. So you're trying to release the aggressive energy and the anger, but you're doing so through speech. So speech becomes an arena in which you can gratify the desire. That's why the Torah says, you should be aware of this. This is another thing that most people, I don't think, are aware of. That verbal abuse is a biblical violation, lo tonu. That you're not allowed to afflict a person verbally. To attack a person, to insult the person, and to put the person down, to make the person feel hurt through speech is a biblical violation. Lo tonu is yisachiv, you may not afflict. It's called onas devarim, verbal affliction. So on the basis of this, let's go through what the Rambam said. The Rambam said that evil speech corresponds to three major sins. Let's take the first one then, shfichas damim, that it's a form of murder. What does that mean? That means to say that first and foremost, I think a person should recognize, should be aware of the tremendous amount of aggression that everybody has. That's comes with the territory. That's human nature. There's a tremendous amount of aggression. And the amount of aggression that you have exceeds the ability to gratify. What we see in our society today, all of the movies, the television programs, the music, the amount of violence that's being expressed. And I'm not taking a position on whether it should be curbed or whether it should be regulated. No, censorship, I'm not getting involved in that. I'm merely using it to illustrate. So, what the rabbis are saying is that when a person engages in Lashon Hara, it involves three primary instinctual drives. The first of one is the aggressive, is the desire to destroy somebody else, to destroy the person verbally. And the reason why it's more dangerous, and this applies to any form of Lashon Hara, is because you're doing so in a manner which enables you to deny that you're really aggressive. That's what a person, as I said, is searching for. A person is always searching for an arena in which they can gratify their desires without having to face up to the consequences. So therefore, by talking about somebody and venting your hatred and your anger through speech, you're really involved in what's called the spilling of blood. And the truth of the matter is that this type of aggression is probably worse than direct physical. Because the rabbis say that one who embarrasses somebody publicly, it's called malvim p'nei chaver b'ravim, to embarrass another person publicly, and it doesn't hurt to keep reviewing these things, because these are the kinds of things that come up and we engage in them and we're not cognizant. We don't feel that we're doing such a terrible thing. Somebody that would never lift a hand and slap another individual or get involved in a physical fight, but he doesn't mind making a comment in the shul or in another setting, and he knows that the person turns red. In fact, that's the analogy they use. That's why it's like spilling blood, because you see that the blood rushes to his face. They just use that to illustrate the point. The reason why it's worse is because it does more harm. There's no question that since the psyche is much more significant, is much more important to us, the body can heal. The body has a wound, so it'll get better. That's not the worst harm you can inflict. But to degrade a person publicly to embarrass a person publicly is to harm him psychologically in terms of his self-esteem, in terms of his self-confidence. That's the real destruction. Because the real essence of the person is the spiritual element, the psychological element, the self-confidence that the person has. That's why there's a famous story. Even King David, the Torah is very honest, records the sin of King David. You know the matter with Bathsheba, and then he arranged for her husband to be in a very dangerous area in battle, and in his own mind he was acting within the parameters of the law. Then of course he was castigated by the prophet, and he paid a heavy price. But the rabbis tell us that when he was in the study hall, this is talking about righteous people. So even though people study Torah, it doesn't mean that they're perfected. So they would come up to him and they would ask him a question. And the question was, someone who commits adultery, what type of death penalty is he subject to? Now, why did they raise that question? It wasn't because of intellectual curiosity. That's another thing that we do. You see how you see the subtlety of it? There's the indirect attack, the indirect Lashon Hara, where you don't say anything directly, but you bring up a subject, and you just happen to know that this is going to be very embarrassing to this particular person. This person may be involved in some type of a problem with his business, maybe something is being investigated, and you just happen to bring up the subject in a general sense, and you know that that's going to cause that person pain. So David HaMelech answered as follows. He said the death penalty is with choking. That's one of the forms of death penalty. And the person has a share in the world to come. Because the rule is that even people who suffer capital punishment, if they repent, they do tshuva, so they have a share in the world to come. He says, but one who embarrasses his friend in public, ein lo chelek l'olma, does not have a share in the world to come. That was his rejoinder to them. So that's why the Rambam says that a person who's engaging in Lashon Hara is engaging in something which has the potential to destroy his soul to the extent that he doesn't have a share in the world to come. He's engaging in something which is much, much more serious than appears to him. And the second area is arayos, the forbidden sexual relations. So how does that work? How does Lashon Hara, how does evil speech equate, how does it entail the involvement in forbidden sexual relations? Is that difficult? Is that a stretch? Or is that easy to see? Well, as I mentioned before, most of 90% or maybe 95% of the gossip that people are involved in, read the gossip columns, there's a tremendous, I don't know if you noticed it, but there's a tremendous amount of sexual curiosity. Just like there's a tremendous amount of aggressiveness, there's a tremendous amount of sexual curiosity. The sexual instinct of man is extremely powerful, again, to the extent that it can't be satisfied through direct involvement in the activity. That's why our entire society is consumed with sexuality. In virtually every area, the newspapers, television, the movies, the entire culture that we live in, and every aspect of advertisement, every product that's being sold, no matter what it is, in one way or another, to attract attention has to entail a sexuality. It's interesting, as I was preparing for the class tonight, I just wanted to make a point in conjunction with this. Even with regard to the movies, so of course you have categories of X-rated, you have pornography. But then you can have certain types of nudity, and that's even in a serious movie. Because society has this concept of redeeming social value. I'm sure you've heard that term. That's to say that if the movie is just about sex, so then it's pornography. But if there's a very serious theme in the movie, and then the director, who's a very deep intellectual, this is a part of life. And in order to convey what life is about, you have to depict it. And it's vital to the story, because there's no way that you can get across this point without depicting this significant element in the story. So it has redeeming social value. It's not just for the sake of sex. It's really to make a bigger point. So I say that's absolutely nonsense. That's pornography. Because it is, you could see the Torah itself, in describing the lives and histories of certain individuals, you have to make the point. It's valid to make the point that a certain individual engaged in sex with another individual, but there's no need to graphically depict it. You can make that point. Take a look at the movies of old when they weren't permitted to do that. You had some of the most brilliant movies in all different types of areas, and of course you know that the characters have had sex, but it doesn't have to be depicted. Whenever they depict it, it's to create a certain type of a feeling within you. And that's the reason why it's there. There's no justification ever. The Gemara, the Talmud, talks about every area of life and talks about every sexual area of life. And believe me, if you study that area, you will never find any type of an emotional, instinctual gratification. Because it's looking at it from a purely abstract point of view. In the same way that in medicine, a doctor is looking at it from a completely different angle. Does not provide any type of emotional gratification. That's the area. That's another extremely important area in forbidden speech. It's what's called nivel peh, to engage in a certain type of speech, which I guess we'd call it dirty. To talk dirty. Is that prohibited by the Torah? I'd like to read to you a little bit about this from the Rambam in the Guide to the Perplexed. He quotes a very fascinating statement of the rabbis, who say the thoughts about the sin are more dangerous than the sin itself. That's an interesting idea. The thoughts about it, in Hebrew it's kehurei avera, are worse than the sin itself. And you say, why? I mean, the sin is the whole thing. See, that's where Judaism differs. I just mentioned the category of forbidden sexual relations. It's not the fact that the person committed an act. Lashon Hara was saying is forbidden sexual relations, but no act was performed. It means the direction where a person's mind is at, where his mental energy is. That's the real destruction. If a person's mental energy is consumed by fantasy, and that's all he thinks about, that's all he talks about, that's the real destruction of the soul. It's not the act per se. It's only the act insofar as it reflects where the person's energies, where his values are. Now the Rambam says, I can offer a good explanation of this saying. When a person is disobedient, this is due to certain accidents connected with the physical element in his constitution. For a person sins only by his animal nature. Whereas thinking is a faculty of man connected with his essence. A person who thinks sinfully sins, therefore, by means of the nobler portion of his self. And he who wrongly causes a foolish slave to work does not sin as much as he who causes a noble and free man to do the work of a slave. For this specifically human element, with all its properties and powers, should only be employed in suitable work, in attempts to join higher beings, and not in attempts to go down and reach the lower creatures. You know how we condemn lowness of speech, and justly so. For speech is likewise peculiar to man, and a boon which God granted him, that he may be distinguished from the rest of the living creatures. Thus God says, who gave a mouth to man? And the prophet declares, the Lord God hath given me a learned tongue. This gift, therefore, which God gave us in order to enable us to perfect ourselves, to learn and to teach, must not be employed in doing that which is for us most degrading and perfectly disgraceful. He then goes on to make the point that it's for this reason that the Hebrew language is called the holy language, because it does not have any direct terms for certain bodily parts or certain physical actions. For example, the sexual action is called tashmish hamita, the function of the bed. It's euphemistic. Every term which relates to any physical part of the body or any activity, any sexual activity, is always by euphemism, because it recognizes that the very words that you could use words that are very physical, very graphic, and that has a certain effect upon arousing certain emotions in a person. On the other hand, you could look at something from an intellectual standpoint, and you could describe the activity from the abstract. That's why it's called the holy language, because it's perfected. Every term is an expression of relating to something from the abstract, not from the base physical. So that's an amazing idea. that the that to be involved, to use the gift that God gave you, the gift of speech, which is given to a person because of his capacity to be involved in knowledge. So he should, God gave it to him to increase his knowledge, because that's how we communicate, that's how we learn, that's how we raise ourselves to a higher level. That's why he's saying to take that which was designed for the highest possible benefit for a person and use it for the lowest part of a person, to increase and to expand his instinctual side. That is the real essence behind the sin that we're talking about over here. That's why he says that it corresponds to forbidden sexual relations, because through speech a person has the capacity to keep his energy constantly attached to the sexual fantasies. And again and again, although now you're not supposed to take a look at them, but if you remember what you read in the gossip columns, you'll see it's always about some kind of a sexual scandal. I mean, nothing got the country worked up for months and months and months about the Clinton, the scandals that he was involved in. So that's clearly sexual curiosity, the need to know about the sexual foibles of other people. That's the second element. The third element, I think, is the most challenging, and that's why I left it for the last one, and that is, but it also is a form of idolatry. It's considered to be as a heretic, as one who denies his creator. And that's not so obvious on the surface. So the question is, why is engagement in evil speech considered to be a form of idolatry? And there again, yes, Dave?
Well, I think you read it in Maimonides. You said that God gave man the power of speech in order for him to perfect his soul. And you can use it for teaching, and you can use it for learning Torah, or giving us a soul, and telling us that our job in life, really, is to perfect our souls. If you take that gift and you use it for the exact opposite, to lower your soul, then it's actually you're denying God.
But I think it's a good point. I hadn't thought of that point, but it's a good point as well. And that is what Ava is saying is very interesting, that a person should acknowledge that the reason why he has speech is because he's unique, and that's because he has a divine soul. And that's causing him to recognize his creator and to try and follow his creator. By misusing that and using the power of speech just to further be involved in the animalistic is basically to say that I'm nothing more than another animal. So what Ava is saying is that constitutes a denial of the soul. And if you deny the human soul, you're basically denying that there's nothing but the physical. So in a sense, it's a denial of God. That's a good point. But I think that there's another element that has to be recognized. And that is that the prayers, all of the prayers, center around this theme, that the thing that prevents us from a genuine recognition of the Creator is the fact that we tend to overestimate the power of man. And we say that throughout the prayers on the high holidays. We compare the true king, and then but the lower king, the human king, is weak and temporal. But the problem is that we tend to invest too much energy in the overestimation of human power. In fact, the rabbis say that a person that gets up in the morning and he goes out to greet on the way to shul, for example, he stops off to greet some significant individual, some influential person. So he puts aside his davening, his prayers, and he goes to greet that individual. That's akin to idolatry. They say you're rendering that person into an idol, which is a very telling point. It means to say that this determines how a person reacts in these kind of situations, determines what he really believes. A person's on his way in the morning to the shul, so then his focus is he wants to connect. He wants to pray to the Creator because of his basic need. So when a person is in need, he turns to the source. Yeah, but then on the way, he realizes that there's another individual in town and he runs to meet him. He's really saying is that I need that person. That's the person that can really do something for me. So that's why when a person meets somebody who's important, who has connections, He has a tremendous desire to establish a relationship with that person. It's the denial. See, it's the denial of God in the sense that a person is saying that the only reality is the reality of the social situation. And I think that that is something which we should really focus on. That in Lashon Hara usually takes place in these social cliques, in these social gatherings. And a person wants to be prominent, wants to get the approval of the group. And therefore, when you have some interesting tidbit and you relay it, you become the center of attention. And then you get that social approval. So a person that's involved constantly in this type of gossip is using it to ingratiate themselves, but it's based upon a certain way of life which makes the social reality into the essence of everything. And that's something which I think people should really focus in on. Because now I've observed in different communities that for many people their entire life revolves around this one thing, social acceptance, being in the right group, not being in the other group, getting in the clique. You see, teenagers have partake of this. A lot of teenagers, they're still immature. Unfortunately. Well, I mean, have I observed them? I don't know if I observed them. Well, I mean, it's always good to... I don't want to speak Lashon Hara. No, but it's good to be very honest. It's good to be honest and acknowledge the truth. If a person is going to improve in life, it's not enough just to study Torah in the abstract. That's one thing that you have to do, you study Torah in the abstract. And I maintain, by the way, that we're talking about a very high level of idealism over here. And that a person should not walk away and say, well, you know, I'm so far away from that, there's no point in studying that. I don't believe in that. I've always studied by teachers who maintain that even if we're not on that level, we have to know what Judaism demands. Judaism demands a very high level of idealism, but it also recognizes the level that you're at, and that slowly but surely you have to work yourself towards that ideal. The problem is that because people sense a weakness, they begin to distort the ideal, purely because they don't believe that they can reach it, and then they feel a little bit guilty or inferior. That would be wrong. We should have the capacity to recognize the truth and the ideal, even though we're not living up to it right now, but by recognizing it, that gives us the hope that we'll get closer and work our way towards it. And this is something which I think, if a person does not have the capacity to be honest about the kind of life that they're living and the things that are really important to them and the extent of the emotional need and gratification for this type of a social acceptance, which in order to get it may lead them into getting into the types of talk and the types of behaviors which are really harming them from a Torah point of view, then it's going to be very difficult for a person to make any kinds of changes. So honesty about yourself. Even if you're not going to change right now, just to be aware, to acknowledge it, is extremely important. Now, I'd like to pretty much conclude with some practical advice, because, again, I think most people recognize that this type of behavior, to engage in these kinds of behaviors and speech, the misuse of speech, as we've seen, is not just something which harms others, it's something which destroys our own soul, because it keeps us involved in a certain type of level of instinctualism and prevents us from using our mind to get involved in higher ideas, which is really what our purpose is all about. I would just like to end with a little bit of practical advice which might be helpful. And as I said before, the more we understand, the more we can see clearly for ourselves that this is harming us, the easier it will be to control it. There's a very famous case in the Torah, the most famous case in the Torah of someone who spoke Lashon Hara. There's one case in the Torah where the Torah illustrates somebody speaking Lashon Hara and facing the consequences. Who is that, Tamir? Miriam, of all people. And Miriam is one of the greatest people in our history. I didn't go through the story this past this season. It comes out during the summer. It's in Balotra, the end of Balotra. And perhaps we'll do it this time. It's very fascinating, because if you read what the Torah calls Lashon Hara, it seems to be very innocuous. She's not saying anything bad. She couldn't understand why her brother Moshe had separated from his wife. So she complained about it, or she raised an issue about it, to Aaron, and yet that's considered to be Lashon Hara. Nevertheless, the story that comes right after that, Shalach, is the story of the spies, of the Meraglim. So the rabbis say, what's the connection between the story of the spies and the story of Miriam? So the rabbis say, it's to teach the lesson that these spies, they saw that Miriam was punished for speaking Lashon Hara, and nevertheless, they went ahead and they spoke Lashon Hara. What was their Lashon Hara? They spoke badly about the land. They brought back a bad report about the land. It's a land which consumes its inhabitants. They disparaged the land. So the question that always bothered me was, but that's not Lashon Hara. You're not hurting the land. You're not harming a land. If you speak badly about a land, nobody in his own mind would feel that he's engaging in Lashon Hara if he spoke badly about a country. Forget about the people. If he spoke about the people, that's one thing. But if he went to a country and he said, it's not enjoyable, the climate, the weather, it's terrible, he wouldn't feel that he's speaking Lashon Hara. Tell me here.
Well, but just like the law, entire Palestine, this is the whole...
That's true. That's true. So that's what we're saying. My question is, that's a separate sin. The sin of demoralizing the Jewish people, instilling fear in them, is true. That I understand. But that's not Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is evil speech. So that, they mean to say that quite apart, even if it would not have demoralized the people, just by speaking badly about the land, that too is a form of Lashon Hara. Yeah, Murray? I'm sorry.
The holy land, and the God's land, and speaking up part of the land, actually speaking up part of the God.
Okay, that's good. Go ahead.
It's called Diba.
Diba, right, which is speech. Speech. Their sin was really a sin of speech. Evil speech.
I'm not just asking if there's a difference between Diba and Lashon
Hara. No, it's used interchangeably. Diba. They was like the serpent was punished for speech. I would like to share another interpretation with you. See, what was the sin? What was the sin of the spies? Essentially, they were overcome by fear, as we've said. And they couldn't acknowledge the fact that the spies had fear. It's understandable. They looked at the situation, they saw these mighty nations, and they felt that we're going to get wiped out. Of course, they should have been able to overcome that because of their faith in God's promise, but God had promised that he would protect them. But they couldn't. The truth of the matter is they were defeated. That in and of itself, the fact that they had the fear and they felt they couldn't go forward, that would not have brought about any punishment. The problem was they couldn't admit that they had a weakness. They couldn't acknowledge their own weakness. So instead of acknowledging it, they disparaged the land. It caused them to distort. It's not us. The problem is not us. The problem is the situation. We're fine. We're okay. But that land is no good. That's why the rabbis say, Kol ha-posel, mimumo posel. Whoever finds fault with others. You ever find, you must know people that are always criticizing. People that like to criticize others, that like to find fault with others. And they harp on a certain theme. They have one or two themes that they're constantly harping it on. Certain, I'm not going to get into particulars now. Where does it come from? Why are they harping on that particular thing? It's mimumo. It's from their own defect. When a person finds fault with others, and you can make a study of this, constantly always criticizing about a certain specific thing, look at them and you'll see they partake of this defect. Because that's a defense mechanism of the mind. Rather than face up to the thing yourself, you criticize it in others. So you'll see parents, husbands, friends, when they're constantly criticizing about a particular thing, that's a giveaway, that they're really doing it to cover it up from themselves. That's what the rabbi said. So if that's the case, then Lashon Hara, a person's speech, is a window to his own soul. The kinds of things that you're constantly making fun out of others about, analyze. You can study your Lashon Hara, because if you study it properly, you'll learn about yourself. Because the underlying motivation behind it is to prevent you from looking at your own defects. And that's why people love to get together and criticize others and how incompetent they are and how sloppy and how lazy they are and how irresponsible they are. And you have this in professional life, you have this in social life, and you will see that when you are drawn to a certain type of a topic and you like to point out all of those defects that you find in the other person, it's a window to your own soul. Start to look into yourself and you'll see that there's a very good reason why you're doing it, because you have the same thing and you don't want to face up to it in yourself. Koha posel, mimumo posel. Whoever finds fault in others does so from, because that fault really lies within himself. And he's engaging in a psychological mechanism, and that's why the rabbis say that it destroys you. Why does it destroy you? Because by constantly finding fault in others, you're creating this shield which will prevent you from seeing it in yourself. And if you don't see it in yourself, you're never going to work on it. So a person that has this option, that has this outlet to blame others, is guaranteed that he'll never find the fault in himself, and he'll never perfect himself. So that's why he'll live his life in an imperfected state. And of course, as we said before, it destroys three people: the speaker, the listener, and the one that you're talking about. And Ben hit it right on the head. It was the one who receives it is destroyed the most. And of course, Abe's point seems to make sense. I would think it's the one who initiates. The person who received it, he's reacting to it. Yeah, I heard a very interesting explanation on this one. And that is to say, it means, who is destroyed the most? Well, we're talking about destruction. The entire theme we're talking about is to engage in certain kinds of behaviors which enable you to gratify certain emotions and shield you from having to look at yourself. So in terms of tshuva, in terms of repentance, in terms of overcoming the defect, who is the most removed? The speaker or the listener? The speaker, at least, there's some hope, because he'll feel a twinge of guilt because he committed the action. So he's closer to a recognition that he did the wrong thing. But from that perspective, the listener is the furthest removed from tshuva, because he says, I didn't do anything. I didn't initiate. The person's talking. What am I supposed to do? Cover my ears? Walk away? I didn't do anything. I just listened. That's why the Rambam's perspective over here, who is harmed the most? The one that's harmed the most is the one that partakes of it and is furthest removed from acknowledging the truth about himself. So I just thought to give a general elucidation of some of the issues that are involved. As we've seen, speech is a very serious area, and it's impossible to lead any kind of a true Torah life and a perfected Torah life unless a person begins to work on his speech. And through a person's speech, you can really have a sense of where they are, what their values truly are. And I think that there's different ways you go about it. To simply try and exercise control all the time is very difficult. That's the way most people try and do it, to try and exercise control, which is, you should try and do that. Conscious control, avoid situations, all this is very, very good. But the way I look at it, in the long run, the only way a person's speech, the kind of speech he's involved in, is really going to change is by the types of areas that he's involved in. It says, for example, a person that's interested in ideas and knowledge and learning, so that's what he talks about. A person talks about the things that interest them. So you can cultivate. Just like you can cultivate a taste for fine wine, you can cultivate a taste for good speech. When a person, you outgrow certain things. When a person is young, so we all like sports. Right? When you're a teenager, most teenagers are really involved in sports. But it's not just playing the game, it's watching. And it's not just watching, you can talk about it for hours, endlessly and endlessly. As you get older, you sort of outgrow it. Not everybody, but some people... Some people outgrow it because, you know, you experience things that are more interesting, more fascinating. Then I would say, you still can enjoy watching a game, but then you can't talk about it endlessly. There's just nothing there to talk about. How much can you talk about it? So you sort of outgrow it. And the same is true with regard to Lashon Hara. The more you cultivate a taste for good conversation, a conversation, it doesn't always have to be about Torah. The Torah describes about Eliezer, the Sichas Chulin, the ordinary talk of Chachamim. When the Chachamim, the wise people, got together, the sages, the scholars, they get together and talk. Their talk is a different level of talk, even if they're talking about mundane matters. But they have an analytical approach. Even if you're talking about something political, then there's a deeper understanding. So they're involved in ideas. If you cultivate a taste for good talk, for good speech, At the same time, you can cultivate a distaste. A distaste. A person doesn't enjoy it. Not because he has a guilt or he has a certain religious emotion. He just doesn't find it interesting. A person that's involved in an idea. And that's what I think, that's what I'm trying to do actually. When we study on Shabbos and we go through something in Chumash and we ask a question and then we find something very, very deep which we didn't see on the surface, and there's a certain fascination. I mean, the reason why I give out the sheets on Friday night or on Shabbos to take home to prepare at the table to discuss something that you read in the Torah. If you read you read the Parsha and you ask a good question, the problem is that we weren't trained to do this in school. It's too superficial. It doesn't apply to our life. It's just a religious thing. But if you get beyond that and you get into the ideas and you ask good questions and you give good answers, eventually you'll get involved. You'll begin to enjoy that kind of conversation. You'll see some real merit in it. And the other kind of conversation you're not going to get any benefit from. You will cultivate a distaste. So that's, in my opinion, the real goal. We really can't move forward in one particular area in isolation. True progress is to use speech, as the Rambam has said, for its true purpose. To be involved in the Torah, in the world of knowledge. It's not only Torah. The world of knowledge, Torah encompasses all knowledge. In the world of ideas. And when a person does that, then he can really deal with the particulars. And then it's much, much easier, because the kind of speech, just like talking about sports all the time, no longer gives him any kind of an enjoyment because it's too trivial. So too, talking about foolishness and other people's defects is so meaningless to him, gets no enjoyment out of it, that will begin to diminish naturally. And that's what the psalmist said. Mahati Torah Secha. He proclaimed this idea before God, expressing his enjoyment. How much do I love your Torah? Tisi Chasi Kalayam. That's my speech all the day. That's what I talk about all the time. So I hope that as a result of this, we'll have a greater understanding of this area. And of course, everything should motivate us to be involved in the study of Torah, the appreciation and the love of Torah, and then all of the ethical virtues will follow naturally. I thank you. Yeah, then we'll get to you others. All right, then we'll get down. Yeah, okay.
If the listener is doing it, is listening because the other person is very upset about something, and the person that's very upset kind of knows that it's not going to go any further, aren't they sort of that, doing it in a good way?
Yeah, it's a good question that's being raised.
Just so that there isn't more evil.
Yeah, alright. There's many practical questions. Yeah. There's many practical questions. I haven't gone into all the practical questions, and it might be a good idea at some point to have a follow-up on the practicalities. I just wanted to go into the underlying idea and the philosophy. However, an area where this issue arises, of course, is in therapy. A person's going for therapy, psychological help, so they have to talk about certain things that happen to them in their life. Could be, may sometimes have to do with their parents, it could be with friends, and basically you're communicating negative information about somebody to a third person, and then the question arises, how can you do it? Is that considered to be Lashon Hara? Generally, I'm talking in general terms, generally no, that's not Lashon Hara. Because as I've said, the problem with disparaging others is because what you're trying to do is to cover up your own defect. It's covering your own defect by disparaging somebody else. But here, that's not the objective. To the contrary, you're undoing, you're going in the other direction. You see, you're trying to figure out what it is. Any good psychologist will try and point out what your problem is, what your defect, why did that bother you? So therefore, the objective is not to destroy the other person. The objective is really to find out what your own hidden emotion is. So that would be in line with the process of tshuva. So that would not be in general, that's not the case. And you are permitted that in the confidence, of course there's confidentiality there, and the therapist hopefully is a professional and keeps the confidence. In that context, if it's therapeutic, then it's in line with the goal of the Torah. Yes. I'm sorry, Ellie was next. I'm sorry.
I'm not asking a question. I'm just adding something to say. there's a book, the Chofetz Chaim, A Daily Companion, which is goes to less than a day, and actually goes to a lot of the practicalities of all the aspects of Lashon Hara and Hotzah Shemra and all that stuff. And actually, I do it with my wife every night. It's only one page a night. It's an amazing book again. So that would have a lot of the things, a lot of day-to-day practical stuff. So it's fun.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Elliot.
Years ago, American politics, American political scene, you're never allowed to say anything bad about another person that pertains to the person's personal life. Now, if you look at some movies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, matter of fact, you'll never see him in a wheelchair because that was perceived as being negative. You want the public to know that he was not able to walk. Public homeware, any possible affairs that the person would have in life, that was just, strictly off limits. Today, anything goes. American politics. Food politicians will hire detectives to try to look up dirt in the person's background to try to promote that in a campaign. Now, where do you draw the line in terms of from person, in terms of engaging in politics, or even engaging in discussion about... Yeah.
That's a big question. We should have a symposium. This is a very fascinating question. I thought about that. I'll give a brief answer. I can't explore all the areas. But if you're running for office today, so it's obvious that you have two objectives. You want to promote your own agenda, but you want to tear down the other candidate. Now, it's one thing to tear down his agenda. You're not talking about him personally, but clearly, you're also going to be trying to tear down the person. The person has got serious defects. That would be a serious problem. Israel is not one according to Jewish law, so the candidates, again, it shows you, the point shows you the dangers. We accept all these things as being, okay, acceptable. If candidates debate and one embarrasses the other one, if you can put them down. There were some big moments. They did some documentaries on the big debate. Do you remember the one with Quayle? Remember that debate? And Benson, I believe. Yeah. Lloyd Benson? And he got him with that remark. He had said something about the fact that innocently he walked into a big trap. He was saying about his experience that he had the same amount of experience that John Kennedy had when he ran. So Benson really honed in on him and he says, I know John Kennedy. Da, da, da. You're no Kennedy. And he was like, wiped out. And that became the big, the big... Now, well, you could take it that, but the people watching it didn't look at it as a compliment. And to do that, we take all this as being fine. It's politics. Also, another thing which is, if the person is a public personality, so somehow or other they're not protected anymore. You can get up on TV and make fun out of them, And that's clearly forbidden. In terms of a debate. It's not permitted. You're involved in a very serious violation, malbim p'nei chaver b'rabim, to embarrass somebody publicly. To the extent that even if it's a matter of a Torah debate against, let's say against people that are denying the Torah, one has to be very, very careful. You're allowed to refute the points, but where it's going to, you got to be careful where it's going to cause a public embarrassment. I mean, it's not something we can just ignore. So it's a very serious issue. If I was, ideally, if a person, I never understood why a candidate has to go get up and tear down the other individual. I mean, you should basically present your own program. This is what I offer. This is what I'm running. This is what I believe in. This is what I'll try and do. And you have a right to say, and the other plan, I believe, is no good. But to attack the other person, I don't see the necessity for it. It's become part of the political culture. But according to the Torah, you would not be allowed to do it. Yeah.
One thing I think the difference would be whether you're being objective or being subjective. And it's true of news reporting also, that really the difference where the line could be drawn, if you're being objective, I see it as being acceptable. As soon as you become subjective, it really isn't.
If it's objective.
Correct.
Right. Okay, yeah.
And
yeah,
in the political arena also. If you're presenting something objectively, I don't really see that as being a form of Lashon Hara.
If you're presenting it objectively?
Yes.
Now, Let me put it to you. The last time in recent history where this became a major, major problem in Israel, I spoke about it at the time after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. And for many, many months, there was a campaign of vilification, which was engaged by many rabbis as well, not just non-religious people. Real personal vilification, referring to him as a chamberlain and a traitor and a collaborator, with the worst possible terms. And I wrote it at the time, I wrote about that, even though I disagreed with what he was doing, but no one had a right to engage in personal, but he was a lawyer, he was a hero, he was a great leader. I mean, what he was doing, he did because at that time he thought that this was necessary. It was a policy thing. And interestingly enough, many of the people who engaged in personal slander and Lashon Hara were rabbis, because they got carried away with this position. I'm not going to judge them why they did it or not, but it's wrong. Yeah, what was the question?
I was talking about the idea of the public right to know.
Public doesn't have a right to know, I'm saying. Oh, yeah. Does not have a right to know.
Well,
it's nobody's business.
In a sense, over the past X number of years, you know, let's say you have to do athletes who are public figures, many of whom are stars, many of whom children looked up to as, idolized them or once, as such. And these people, have been involved in serious situations in their personal lives. And the discussion became, well, is their private life part of public because, the kid looked up to them, or is their professional life to be made public? Is that kind of thing that's going on?
I hear, but I'd say you have to be very careful. The case where we had it recently, we discussed it during the summer, was the case with the NCSY, the OU situation. Well, it was Rabbi Lanner, it's public knowledge. And there was a serious issue, because this was brought out before the public, and obviously he was publicly slandered, and his career is destroyed. And to a certain extent that came up. The issue over there was an issue of a need to know the defense for bringing out the information publicly was that without it there'd be no way to stop it, that they'd made many attempts over the years to inform the authorities, the people involved. They didn't do anything, and therefore it was thought that the only way to prevent people from being hurt was to bring out the information. In that case, if that is true, assuming that there's no other way to do it, and there was a lot of evidence that there wasn't any other way, then it would not be Lashon Hara. Because then you're not doing it to tear a person down, then you're doing it to save somebody's life. Obviously. I'm sorry.
So how come you have everything from biblical figures to dead politicians, how come you're allowed to go over and over their mistakes publicly again and again, which seems to defame these people?
That's a good point.
Even just bringing it up over and over again, whatever their mistakes were and what their sins, and in some cases maybe you could argue in the biblical figure you're doing it to teach a lesson. Is that the whole argument? You're allowed to defame someone if you are teaching a lesson? Why are we allowed to sit here and go over and over the mistakes of people, whether they're alive or dead or anything? I mean, it seems to me you're constantly bringing them down but by doing that, we do bring them down. I've not
done the rabbit. No, it's a good question. It's a good question. The cases that are brought down in the Torah that would only indicate that that's all through prophecy, from God, and well, you have two categories of people. When you're studying something in the Torah, it doesn't partake of what I said. You're not doing it because you're engaging in the enjoyment of the disparagement. This is a person that has no relationship to you at all. So the Torah has revealed that if the person's a wicked person, so if a person's a wicked person, he's not entitled to this kind of protection anyway. We're talking about good people, essentially good people. We're not talking about, basically the Torah recounts the deeds of wicked people, so we should learn from it. We should learn what happened to them. We should learn what motivated them and so forth. Now, in the case of the other individuals, for example, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, even he sins. But he's a righteous individual. He's a righteous individual. So there's a we're not sitting around engaging in Lashon Hara by Moshe Rabbeinu. We're just studying something in the abstract. So studying something in the abstract, in the context of study, that is to say, we're not talking about the person of Moshe. We don't have any relationship with the person of Moshe. But the Torah has revealed a certain action, and we're trying to understand what caused it. We had one of our sessions on the sin of Moshe. But nobody got the sense that we're trying to tear down Moshe. It was rather to try and understand what motivated him, so that that's necessary for our perfection. If you're just talking about someone just because he's dead, you're just talking about somebody to hash up things about his life and his sexual scandals and so forth, so then you're engaging in the same base behavior. It doesn't really matter from that standpoint. See, what I'm trying to say is what the nature of the talk is. That if the nature of the talk is to try and study and understand something, and you can tell when it's that kind, and it's a serious kind of an analysis, so then it's legitimate. But if the nature of the talk is to laugh and poke fun, then it's Lashon Hara. That's why I said that even in the context of therapy, you can talk about what somebody else did, because your objective is not to tear the other person down. Now, you want to focus. You want to focus on how it affected you and how it hurt you. So that's a different kind of a speech. So therefore, the kind of speech we're involved in the studying of the figures of Tanakh, is to learn. It's part of the study of Torah. So anything which is legitimately part of the study of Torah can't be Lashon Hara. Okay, I think we'll stop here because of it's getting late. Not because...